You take, let us assume, a third toke, long and slow. You vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling of the flame, and a tone, and there is this.
All right, welcome. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com.
There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say who.
Alright, listeners, welcome. This is Fane of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment. I'm one of your hosts, Dustin Sunflower. And on today's show, we're going to be talking with Liesl Forrest about the new play,
Foreplay.
And, LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, with Jack Cole. Yeah, this is going to be a huge interview. Reverend DeMuzzi is going to swing this one in from, I think, the States. This is an amazing movement, an amazing activism-based movement. It's awesome. Some of the news items: Bad Muffler gets a man pinched. Canada backs Terminator seeds. A leaked document from the UN. Canada loves Terminator seeds. We just can't believe it. And Daryl Hannah calls out for legalization of marijuana and mushrooms. We'll have our weekly segment of Bad Cop No Donut. We'll find out what bad things cops have been doing around the world. Well, North America, basically. A cocaine story. Boo, boo, hoo. And then, had a successful Beards for Bread. It was awesome. The people of Nelson really came through. And I want to thank everybody who donated the money. All of the money is going to the food cupboard, and that'll keep some groceries on the shelves and people behind the scenes. So that's totally awesome. And thank you, Nelson. We love you. Last week was Hash Wednesday. I hope all of you had some beautiful bubble hash or some Afridi hashish, whatever you had. We hope that you had a great Hash Wednesday. You gotta love holidays like that, that's for sure. Okay, here we go. We're gonna go to a tune of Freestylers.
Pull it one more time. I wanna go behind the vibes, got me due to certain things and things in.
Surrender.
in the new year, them claims it in my like way. We are the original rude boys, and if a boy try this, sanity they done bet we got. And I'm again with a roller. In a few with hunger, we make a little stroll. And we buy a silk shirt, 2 pieces of gold. But if I'm with him, we add it with the billfold. This is not Robert De Niro or Al Pacino. There's a freestyle as you end up in a sorrow. Boom, boom, say you never see tomorrow. Boy, you end up in a sorrow. Boom, boom, but at the sound of the gun. Boom, boom, you see a boy in my run. Boom, boom, and we just have fun.
Whoops, that's part of a freestyler's thing. Not suitable for most audiences. But, okay, just 1 second here. We have someone on the line. Liesl, are you there?
I'm here. Here I am.
So, foreplay, is this some kind of golf comedy? No, I'm kidding, but... I saw the golf ball and I was like, what? Did I get the wrong?
No, you're right. No, yeah, it takes place on a golf course.
It does for real?
It does for real.
Oh my God. That's wild.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
So, wait a second. Rumor has it from industry insiders that there could possibly be reenactments of cannabis smoking.
Yes.
Not the real thing,
no.
But reenactments.
No, we can't do the real thing on stage for a variety of reasons. But we were thinking it would. Too bad they don't have like marijuana incense that you can burn in the theater.
Oh my God! It
so
smells.
At least, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would smell real. You get the effect.
But like, what flavor would you use? Like, you know, White Grizzly, Hindu Kush.
Well,
like,
you know what the funny thing is?
What?
There's a little story in the play about Skeedy Island weed,
ooh,
which we call Giddy Coastal. I don't know if that's the right name for it, but yeah, from this experience that I had when I was hitchhiking on Vancouver Island, and there was this old dude. He's like, "You ever smoked Skeedy Island weed?" I was like, "No," so I did, and whoo, yeah, that was it for that.
Right on. I remember Texada Time Warp was an especially potent island strain.
Yes, I've heard of it. I've even heard of it.
So when is the play going on?
When is the play going on? It's starting on Wednesday night. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at the Capitol Theater.
Okay.
And we have a Skookum special that if you buy your ticket at the Capitol before 7 o'clock on Wednesday night. They have Tuesday and Wednesday to buy tickets. Then it's 2 for 1 for Wednesday.
Whoa.
That's a pretty hot little deal.
Sweet, that's a Valentine's Day gift in the making.
Yeah, so you can go with your honey, go have some laughs together. Think
foreplay.
About golf and foreplay.
Foreplay, strict behavior conduct enforced at the performance.
Yeah, foreplay leads to a good time.
Whoa!
You know?
I can't imagine the after party at at the foreplay.
Yes, we've been doing a little imagining, and it does make us blush somewhat. No, no, we're all very chaste people.
Do you think it fits in good with the Halloween? Saint Halloween's Day.
Saint Halloween's Day?
No, Valentine's Day? Is there a love story in there or anything?
It is about love.
Okay.
I think it's about loving yourself, ultimately.
Yeah.
When you get right down to it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's love in there. There's love and lust and friendship and there's disagreements, which I guess are part of love, right?
Yeah, conflict.
And conflict. That's a growth as a human being. That's about love.
Yeah.
Letting go of your fears.
Good. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's about love. There's definitely love going on. Yeah. Sweet. Plus the love of fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun time. We're having a fun time rehearsing it, which is really nice.
Nice. And this is a local production, right?
It
written,
is.
Produced, directed.
It is. The show's been really collaborative. We've really worked together, all four actors, and putting it together. And Jeff and I wrote it a while ago. Before we were all parental, we wrote it, and then we pulled it out and went, hey, you know, that's pretty funny.
Pre-parental?
Yeah.
The foreplay led to a time of birth and child rearing?
It did. So be careful of that foreplay also.
Be careful, folks.
That's right.
Okay, so...
what else do you know? Starts at 8 o'clock. What? Wade Swagger is in it. Wade,
whoa.
He works up at the brewery. He's a hunk of a guy.
Wade, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and he plays a local celebrity actor.
Hello.
And Jeff Forst, and he plays a local club pro, golf pro. And myself, Lisa Forst, and I play a realtor, Alex.
Oh.
And Jocelyn Carver is playing a wealthy heiress.
Ooh.
She's kind of a star.
The Jackie Onassis
kind of
the foreplay.
She's really hot.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been great having you on the show. And listeners,
nice
get
here.
Out there. Get the Valentine's Day special.
That's right. Oh, and you know what? You know what I've learned about the theater? I'm just going to put out there.
Okay.
The best thing about buying your tickets in advance is then you can smoke a huge fatty before you come in, and you don't have to go wait in line for your ticket. You can just go sit right down in your seat, and that's cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cruise right for the spot.
Totally.
Okay.
There you go. Thanks so much, Dustin.
Woo-hoo.
Rock on.
Yep, local theater is where it's at.
It's a fun thing.
Because, we got the talent, we got the goods. Let's support it and get it rolling.
Yeah.
Rolling.
Yeah. Woo.
Okay.
All right.
Blessings.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was Liesl from the play for play. So get your Valentine's Day specials at the Capitol Theater. We've got so many gifted people in this community, gifted actors, gifted production people, gifted directors. We're just blessed. And so if you want to see more local theater and you want to see more stories about what's going on in our lives for real, contemporary, like, written by people who go to Oso Negro and buy food at the co-op and swim in the lake like you do and have real life experiences that kind of reflect your life, we got to support local theater. So get in there, yo. Let's go for a little senza mia. No, we'll wait for that for a bit. But I got a haircut, just so you know. Like, I got, and it's totally changed my appearance, but pretty well still quite hairy on the inside. But just wanted to say thanks to Sayla for, like, okay, guys. I talking about yourself, boom, boom, blah, blah. But last time I went and got my haircut, which was years ago, you go to a barber. There's like couple Playboys on the shelf. He's got like a little bucket of, you know, hair clippers and a couple combs and, you know, the coat rack and small chairs and stuff. But I went for this haircut and it was like wild. They, you know, braided my hair, cut the braid, gave me the braid, knew that I wanted to keep it sacred. And then, you know, full scalp massage, neck massage. By the end, you're just like, And then over for the shampoo and mint enriched something or other in my hair that made my scalp like tingle and cool. And then off to a haircut. Like, sorry, but getting a real haircut is a lot more of an experience than just going to the barber. And I, you know, the barbers who cut off our beards, barber. But anyway, for the haircut, boy, whoo, what an experience! I'm telling you. So, yeah, thanks a lot. That was quite wild. I don't really cut my hair an average of like 2 or 3 times a decade. So it was nice to see that you can get kind of a all-around spiritual haircut. It was crazy. But just as a joke, I'm going to play this next song. It's Huey Lewis in the News. And I heard it the other day. Someone played it for me, and I just thought it was hilarious because it kind of fit the situation. So this is Huey Lewis in the News. It's Hip to Be Square.
Take punishment and had to settle down. And I'm playing.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to Kootenai Club Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live from Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaiclubradio.com, 96.5 FM if you're down the Kootenai Lake, and Argenta. Stay tuned. All right, listeners, we got Reverend DeMuzzi online. Reverend, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, he's there. So, pretty excited about this interview because there's very few people that I consider more radical than people who fight the war on drugs in the States. And this guy goes probably at one of the tops, you know?
Well, yeah, there's something just extra brave about it when, you know, you're right in the heart of the oppression there. The fellow we're going to speak to is Jack Cole. He's a former narcotics officer from the New Jersey State Police Force from 1964 to 1991. And he's busted everyone from teenager smoking joints to multi-million dollar cocaine trafficking organizations.
Wow.
So he didn't just, you know, he's not just fighting it. He's, you know, he's, it's interesting. He went from one sort of polar extreme to another. So it's going to be interesting to talk to him. We want to talk to him about good cops, bad cops, and what it's like to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
So, Dustin, why don't you put me on hold, and for a second I'll dial up Jack Cole, and then when we come back, we'll have Jack on the line.
Okay, do. Here we go. We'll get a little bit of slightly stupid Cincinnati.
All right, this next song here is for all the Sensi smokers out there in San Diego. It's called Sensa Mia.
But everybody wants to get some
Sensa Mia.
And everybody wants to get some.
You wanna Sensa Mia.
And everybody wants to get some.
They wanna Sensa Mia.
And everybody wants to get some.
You wanna Sensa Mia.
You know that it's better to smoke it Saturday morning. Dime, dime, dime. But when you wake, you back, you know that everything will be just fine. So fine. You know that it is better to smoke that shit Saturday morning time. But when you wake, you back, you know that Georgia be just fine, so fine. Now people said everybody wants to get some.
You want a Centimia.
And everybody wants to get some.
Give me my Centimia.
And everybody wants to get some.
I want a Centimia.
And everybody wants to get some. But then he called the doctor.
For me.
But yes, this is a case of emergency.
Emergency.
You know we rockin' 105.3.
Be
coming to give a good to loving like she giving it to me.
So listen to people saying,
but everybody wants to get some
sense of me.
And everybody wants to get some.
Give me my sense of me.
And everybody wants to get some.
Well, then he deserves to be.
And everybody wants to get some.
Next song here is for all the Sensi smokers out there in San Diego.
Welcome back, listeners. We have our interview online. Reverend DeMuzzi?
Yes.
Jack?
Yes.
Okay, we got it. So, Reverend, why don't you introduce?
Well, once again, it's Jack Cole from LEAP. That's Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Jack, you were formerly a narcotics officer with the New Jersey State Police, is that correct?
That's true. 26 years.
Wow, that's a long time. And what made you want to found LEAP?
What does LEAP stand for again, though?
LEAP stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And it's a group that was created to give voice to all the current and former members of law enforcement that believe the war on drugs is not only a dismal failure, but it's a terribly destructive policy. We would rather support alternative policies. Policies will lower the incidence of death, disease, crime, and addiction without sending generations of our young people to prison for drug offenses. We believe in regulation and control rather than prohibition. We think it's just a better way to go. You were asking, though.
What? No. Yesterday, I was listening to some of your former interviews, and I heard a harrowing tale involving the CIA. Could you tell us about that?
Harrowing tale. There's many harrowing tales about the CIA. You gotta give me a hint what you're talking about here.
Well, apparently you were talking about the fact that, you know, one of the things that sort of made you feel like you wanted to, found this organization or move away from the law enforcement kind of activities that you were doing on behalf of Prohibition was the fact that, you know, that it wasn't, these drugs weren't being stopped at a higher level. They were just, the CIA was just letting them in.
Well, there's some truth to that, certainly. Since the CIA has been created, it has been using the fact of drug prohibition as a way of conducting foreign policy for the United States, in that if they don't actually help get the drugs in, they certainly look the other way while people in the countries that we were interested in destabilizing, whichever side the people are on that are with the CIA, they allow them to sell drugs and use that money to buy guns in order to fight their secret wars. But that's far, far removed from the real reasons that I wanted to start this organization. See, there must be 100 reasons just as strong as that why we should end drug prohibition. And the problem with talking about the CIA and what it's doing is you tend to get into this conspiracy theme. And you really don't even have to go there in order to talk about all the horrors we've created in this war. You know, what we've done in this war, I'll give it to you in a nutshell. We spent 35 years so far fighting this war. It started in 1970. And in that 35 years, we spent well over $500 billion to fight that war. Every year that we continue it, we're spending another $69 billion to continue this thing. And what we have to show for it is each year we are arresting now 1,600,000 people in this country alone for nonviolent drug arrests. Our prison population quadrupled in a 20-year period, making building prisons the fastest growing industry in the United States. Mm-hmm. Now that's not something I, you know, look forward to seeing in my country. Give you some context for that. The United States has 4.6% of the population of the world, but we have 22.5% of its prisoners right here in this land of freedom. There's something wrong with that picture to me. And with all this money that's so ill spent, all these lives that we're destroying, all we really have to show for this hard, hard work of the police is that today, drugs are cheaper, they're more potent, and they're far easier to get than they were in 1970 when I started buying them undercover. Now, to me, that's the very essence of a failed public policy.
What do you
have to change it?
When you were an officer, were you expected to make a certain amount of busts? Like, was there an expectation to kind of fill a prison quota, or?
You know, well, sure there is. There's a. I'll give you an idea how things have grown and changed. In 1970, see, I joined the New Jersey State Police in 1964. We had 1,700 troopers back then and a 7-man narcotic unit. And then when the war on drugs really got underway was 1970, and the reason it got underway was because Richard Nixon coined and created the phrase in 1968 when he was running for president. And it really had nothing to do with drugs. It had a lot to do with the fact that he was running for the second time for president. He really wanted to make it that time. He knew that if he ran being a strong anti-crime guy, that'd give him a lot of votes. But boy, if he could be in charge of a war, you know, wow.
Oh my God.
And as we all know, it worked. And in his first year in office, he got the U.S. Congress to pass funding bills that gave massive amounts of money to any police department willing to hire officers to fight his war on drugs. And to give you an idea how massive these things were, the New Jersey State Police, which, as I said, had 1,700 officers in a 7-man unit from 1964 to 1970, when I went into narcotics in October 1970, overnight, we went from a 7-man unit to a 76-person bureau.
Oh,
whoa. 11 times. Wow. Expansion. You know, anybody who knows anything about administrations has to know that when you expand an organization by 11 times, there's a lot of expectation. And since police officers are expected mainly to arrest people, the expectation with us was that in the coming year, we'd arrest at least 11 times as many people for drug violations as we did the year before. And it becomes, at some point, it just becomes a rat race where the main idea isn't to stop drugs, it's just to arrest people.
Tell me how police inflate drug arrests. Do they often exaggerate, say, the size of a pod operation? The number of plants?
Well, we certainly did the first year. In the first year of the war on drugs in 1970. And there was a reason that we did, obviously. You know, if you go back and you look at the statistics from 1970, you find that we really didn't have much of a drug problem at the beginning of the war on drugs. As a matter of fact, the main problem we had in the United States, if there was any, was soft drugs. Drugs like marijuana, hashish, some psilocybin, mushroom-type thing, LSD. Hard drugs such as methamphetamine, cocaine, heroin were almost unheard of in the United States at that time, certainly unheard of compared to what they are today. So when we hit the streets and we're supposed to go out and arrest drug dealers, there just weren't that many drug dealers out there. Give you an idea about what I'm talking about, look at it statistically and you'll find that the likelihood of anybody dying as a result of the war on drugs in 1970 was less than the likelihood of them falling down the steps in their own house and killing themselves. It was less than the likelihood of them choking to death on their own food at their dinner table. And as far as I know, we haven't started a war on food or stairways yet, you know. Am I still with you here?
Yep.
Have you seen that like a possession arrest has been maybe, say, inflated to a trafficking arrest or something?
Oh, absolutely. And the reason is because there weren't a whole lot of druggies out there, a whole lot of people to be arrested. What we started out doing was we started basically arresting drug users and calling them drug dealers. What we'd do, there weren't drug dealers on every street corner or in every school like there are today, so they'd send undercover people like myself out to infiltrate small groups of people, friendship groups, maybe of high school or college or people in between, groups of maybe 10 to 15 people at a time, And we'd get in there and become their friends, and because we were their friends, come a Friday night when school's out, they're out of work, somebody might say, hey, you want to get high? And of course, if nobody did say that, I was always there to offer that suggestion, because that's what we did. And if anybody went along with that, said, yeah, let's get high, then one of the friends who had access to, say, the family car might go around and take orders from all the other friends. Now, the family car or some sort of transportation was really important back then, because I was working about 30 miles outside of Manhattan in a little suburb in New Jersey. And you couldn't buy drugs in the suburbs. You had to go to the city in 1970 to buy it. So one friend would go around and take orders from the other young folks there. What do you want? And somebody might say, well, give me a couple of joints. This is just enough for that evening to get high. Someone might ask for a couple hits of acid, or even maybe Valium was a big thing back then. A couple hits of Valium. And I would only order a tiny amount like that myself. So the person would get in their car, and they drive to the city, and they buy it, and they come back, and they'd hand it out to their friends. And, of course, as soon as they did that, they became a drug dealer. But, you know, they didn't even have to do that to be a drug dealer, because the way the laws are written, the laws say it's illegal to distribute a controlled, dangerous substance. And then it lists the substances. It doesn't say anything in there about anyone having to get paid for that distribution. So the mere passing of, say, a marijuana cigarette from one person to another makes you a drug dealer. You remember that? Who was that guy that was in the news?
That was Mark Emery.
Everybody would remember him, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Years ago, the one that used to smoke but didn't inhale.
No, that was a different fellow. You're not talking about President Clinton, are you?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Well, let me tell you, if I would have infiltrated young Bill Clinton's friendship group when he was smoking but not inhaling, it wouldn't have made a bit of difference whether he inhaled or not, because if I was the person standing next to him when he handed the joint over to the next person, he would have committed a felony just by that handing of that cigarette to me. And about a month later, the police would have been kicking down his door, dragging him out in chains, never to be an attorney, much less the president of the United States.
Smash his saxophone.
Excuse me?
They would smash his saxophone.
Well, we might very well have. There was a lot of street justice going on. As
like frontier justice.
Referred to it.
When you get into it, when you first started doing this, was there a sense of I'm doing this because this is morally right, and so you have that feeling like you're doing something, you're actually doing a service, or did there come a time at some point when you felt like these people really you felt like a kinship with the people that you were connecting with as an undercover?
Well, Reverend, the first thing you mentioned is so true. You know, it's a terrible thing when we train our police officers to go to war. And that's what the metaphor of a war on drugs does. You know, when police in a democratic society are trained to go to war, they have to have an enemy. And the enemy becomes the citizens of their country. And quite literally, that's what it is. Because if you look at DEA stats today, they say that by 1999, 87 million people in this country above the age of 12 had used an illegal drug. Now, that made every single one of them vulnerable to arrest. And it made every one of them the enemy. And we weren't just trained that these were bad people. We were trained that these were the scum of the earth. These were some sort of practically demonic beings. And our job in fighting this war was to win at all costs. You know, when you fight a war, it's a no-holds-barred thing.
Yeah.
Of course, the holds that aren't barred any longer are the individual civil rights, the Fourth Amendment, none of that gets in our way.
Is it, do you think it's still that way, basically, for police officers, that they're still trained in that way?
Not nearly as much, but it still happens. It happens far too regularly. Practically every time I pick up a paper, I see some little article about somebody stepping on someone's rights. And it always has to do with the war on drugs. You almost never see. Think of your news articles you've read or heard on the radio or television. You know, you almost never hear of a case where somebody's violating someone's constitutional rights in a murder case or a rape case.
Impaired driving. You know, like someone drinking and driving.
I don't understand.
Well, like, if they were doing drugs, they might get beaten or, you know, there might be a gun battle. But if they're just drinking and driving, there's no, like, there wasn't, like, a takedown and we got the drug dealer, you know? Like, you wouldn't do that to someone. They were high on cocaine and we took them down. You wouldn't say that if someone was drunk. You know what I mean? Like,
Yes. Absolutely. We're not fighting a war on drugs.
Yeah,
fighting
no.
Fighting a war on drugs, yeah. Not drunks. Yeah, it's a completely different feeling, and the young officers tend to believe it, and they're very frightened. I mean, I was very frightened when I started. The people who are training you, if you happen to be an officer, practically instill that fear in you, and then what they do is they say, well, you know, every time you stop a car out there, you can get killed.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. Every time you stop a car, you could get killed. But every time you cross the street, you could get killed, too. But the likelihood of it happening isn't that great. But the young officers get the feeling that this can happen at any moment, and they feel that... people using drugs are their worst enemy, so they sometimes overreact and react too quickly.
Could you attribute that reaction then to the main reason why there is so much corruption in the war on drugs, or are there other factors as well?
No, it's not the reaction that's the corruption. The corruption exists because of greed, and the corruption exists because of prohibition itself. All these things go back to prohibition, you see. We don't have these problems because of drug pharmacology. We have it because of drug prohibition. Let me explain that, because that's a pretty tough thing to be talking about. Think back to prohibition of alcohol. We've been here once before, you know, and it didn't work the first time around. But the first time around, it only lasted 13 years, from 1920 to 1933. In just that little short amount of time, we had the highest rate of murder in the United States. We had the highest rate of corruption of public officials in the United States. But when we finally ended alcohol prohibition, in 1933, that very year, all those stats fell down to almost nothing, and they stayed there until 1968, when war was declared on drugs. And now they have just shot right past the older stats, and we have much worse things going on today. When you prohibit a drug, you don't cause less people to use it. You only accomplish one thing by prohibition, and that is you create an underground market for that drug. And worse, because the drug is illegal, now it's going to be dangerous to distribute that drug. That means that the price, the value of the drug, suddenly is artificially inflated, so much so that between where it's produced or grown, say in Colombia for the United States, or Afghanistan mainly for Europe now, and where it's sold in New York or Seattle or Los Angeles, wherever you want, that value can increase by up to 17,000%. Just think of that. What an obscene profit motive that is. And think of what we're doing here. These drugs, I don't care whether you're talking about marijuana from a cannabis plant or cocaine from a coca bush or heroin from an opium poppy. All we're talking about is weeds, basically. These things will grow anywhere in the world. And they are so hardy. They're such hardy plants. Those of us charged with destroying them, we go down and we pull them up by the roots. We cut them down. We fly over them with helicopters and fixed-wing planes and spray poison on them and also poison the people growing them and all the people in the area, which we don't seem to mind. But the point is we have to go back every year and do it all over again because these plants just pop right back up again.
Yeah.
And because they are so prolific, they have absolute zero value until, that is, we say they're illegal. And as soon as they're illegal, this huge, obscene profit is out there. You know, we've given over 1,000 presentations at LEAP. We have 85 speakers now. And in the 2 years we've been around, we went from 5 founding members, all of us former cops, to over 2,000 members. And now we're not just cops. We're judges, prosecutors, corrections officers, wardens of prisons. We even have former DEA agents who are speakers for us. We have 85 speakers living in 30
and mayors too.
7 other countries. Pardon?
And mayors too.
And well,
at least one, anyways. Vancouver mayor.
Anyway, Vancouver Mayor Larry Campbell is on our board of our advisory board.
And wow.
To be a board member or a speaker for LEAP, you have to have been current or former member of law enforcement. And Larry Campbell was in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police for 12 years. He was 4 years in their narcotic bureau.
Wow.
And then he did 3 years as the coroner of Vancouver before he ran for mayor. You know, the reason he ran for mayor, he told me, was during the 3 years he was the coroner up there, they had the highest rate of overdose deaths in all of North America in that city.
Uh-huh.
Over one a day. Well, 3 years. And he was just beside himself with, you know, worry over what was going to go on here. When he ran for mayor, this to me was a really exciting thing about him. Because politicians are always saying, or people are always saying about politicians, you know, if a politician runs for office as a drug policy reformer, he doesn't have a chance, or she doesn't have a chance. There's no way they'll ever get elected. Well, let me tell you, Larry Campbell ran for mayor of Vancouver, and when he ran, two of his planks in his platform, one was he wanted to legalize marijuana. And the second was he wanted to create safe, supervised injection sites for hard drug users so that they could lower this rate of overdose.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't only elected, he was elected with the largest plurality that has ever existed in a mayoral race in Vancouver.
Wow. Jack, I just want to stop you right there. And I was thinking maybe we could go to a song and station identification, and then we could come back and interview you some more.
Surely.
Okay, here we go. This is System of a Down. This is the song Prison System.
We're not broadcasting now, right, Dustin?
Follow following direct movement to clamp down with your iron fist. Drugs became conveniently available for all the kids. Following direct movement to clamp down with your iron fist. Drugs became conveniently available for all the kids.
Mother, I'm not crack, my smack, my bitch, right here in Hollywood.
Nearly 2 million Americans are incarcerated in the prison system of the U.S.
They're trying to build a prison.
They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison.
For you and me to live in.
Another prison system. Another prison system. Another prison system.
For you and me.
Minor drug offenders fill your prisons, you don't even flinch. All our taxes paying for your wars against the new non-rich. Minor drug offenders fill your prisons, you don't even flinch. All our taxes paying for your wars against the new non-rich.
Mother, I'm not crack, my smack, my bitch, right here in Hollywood.
The percentage of Americans in the prison system has doubled since 1985.
They're trying to build a prison.
They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison.
For you and me to live in.
Another prison system. Another prison system. Another prison system.
For you and me.
They're trying to build a prison for you and me. Oh, baby, you and me.
Boy. Boy.
While research and successful drug policy shows that treatment should be increased.
Boy.
And law enforcement decreased while abolishing mandatory minimum sentences.
Boy.
While research and successful drug policy shows that treatment should be increased.
Boy.
And law enforcement decreased while abolishing mandatory minimum sentences.
Utilizing drugs to pay for secret wars around the world. Drugs are now your global policy. Now you police the globe.
Mother, I'm not crack, my smack, my bitch right here in Hollywood.
Drug money is used to rig elections and train brutal corporate sponsored dictators around the world.
They're trying to build a prison.
They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison.
For you and me to live in.
Another prison system. Another prison system. Another prison system.
For you and me.
They're trying to build a prison. They're trying to build a prison for you and me.
Okay.
Welcome back. You're listening to Kootenai Co-op Radio, 93.5 FM, CJLY, broadcasting live out of Nelson and over the worldwide mycelium on www.kootenaicoopradio.com. You're listening down Kootenai Lake. You're listening at 96.5 FM. And if you're in beautiful Argenta, you're listening also to 96.5 FM. I am so glad those folks at the end of the lake get the signal. That's so sweet. So back on the line we have Jack and Reverend DeMuzzi. You guys still there?
We are, yeah.
Okay, sure. Welcome back.
This is Jack Cole from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and we're interviewing him about, well, I guess about the war on drugs and about his role in this organization. And Jack, so I want to ask you, did it ever occur when you were doing an undercover narcotics investigation that you or another officer felt like it was necessary to take drugs in order to convince the people that you were investigating that you were, you know, not a cop?
Well, apparently, quite a few officers feel like it's necessary. I never did. To me, it would have been the height of the most arrogant and hypocritical thing I could have done to take drugs when I was arresting people for doing that. I worked basically undercover in narcotics for 14 years, so I was certainly out there a lot, and I worked everything from those first years at the beginning of the war when we were just grabbing everyone in sight and inflating our stats a lot. We were arresting even people for smoking pot on the streets. But in the later years, excuse me, I was actually working $1 billion international heroin and cocaine rings.
Wow.
I used to really pride myself on the fact that I didn't have to use any of the drugs. You know, being a good undercover agent is sort of like fiend, half con man, half magician, sleight of hand artist. All you have to do is draw somebody's attention away from what they think they're seeing for a couple seconds, and you can convince them that you're doing almost anything.
Now, did you find that, like, when you were doing your investigations and as the years progressed within the war on drugs, that there was a racial character coming into focus? That
absolutely.
You were starting to
absolutely.
Find that there was, like, a racial kind of edge to it after a certain amount of time?
Like, were you ever directed to go after a particular profile?
Sure. When the war on drugs started, I mentioned to you 87 million people and all of them were vulnerable to arrest. Well, when it started in 1970, there were only about 4 million people, according to DEA, that were drug users. But still, all of them were vulnerable to arrest. And if you remember the history back then, a lot of those folks were anti-war people, against the Vietnam War. And certainly they weren't friends of Richard Nixon. We just decimated that group by arresting those folks for drugs. And then as soon as we took care of most of that, then we turned on the Black Panthers. And that was another group that we pretty much decimated by the drug law violations, by the fact that people were smoking pot and other things.
So it seems like it was really a very cultural, like it was a, you know, the drug war was like a weapon. It was aimed at cultures, you know.
So there's a lot of political things going on here with this war. But for those people who may doubt that there's a, see, the way I look at it is institutionalized racism within law enforcement. And I'm not saying that police are racist. Any individual cop is a racist or anything like that. I'm not even necessarily saying that these drug laws are racist or were racist in their content when they were first created. But certainly their implementation has become racist. And all you have to do is look at the stats over the years to figure out that that's an absolute fact. For instance, if you look at the Federal Household Survey, that tells us how many people in this country are in the drug culture, whether they're users or dealers, whatever they are. And it says that 72% of the people involved in the drug culture